You're listening to episode 0 of season 6 of the GNU World Apples. Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and yes, this is the GNU World Order, which, you know, if you were listening to this podcast previously, then you would, of course, know it as the Bad Apples. And as you can tell, it's wildly different. It's completely a new show. It's just reinvented itself. I don't even want you to go back to listen to those old seasons. They're just completely, like, they're embarrassing. They're so different. So in this episode, as always, we're going to talk about technical kinds of stuff. So if you have an interest in that, stay tuned. Otherwise, we're going to be talking about the Ohio Linux Fest wrap-up by me. We'll be talking about FreeBSD and KDE. We'll be talking about the KDE presence at the Ohio Linux Fest. I'll take some listener feedback, probably. Let's get started, shall we? Okay, so this past weekend, as in yesterday and the day before and today, was the Ohio Linux Fest. That is probably why my voice, if it does sound different, because I've been shouting and talking all weekend. Not shouting per se, but speaking loudly over crowd noises and things like that. So the Ohio Linux Fest 2010, I think, was, you know, like I say, I mean, it's actually, it just ended today. I just got back into town. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what it was like. So, let's see. The festival was fantastic. It was it remains just like one of those really solid go-to festivals if you want a really good technical conference. It was as good as ever. Possibly, in my humble opinion, better than ever. It really was. I felt really good about this year. The Friday talks, which started last year. Last year they were a little bit disorganized. It was a little bit messy, let's say. But this year it was just like part of the conference. It was divided up into different rooms, so they actually had different tracks, I think. But not too many, you know. It was only enough tracks to support the crowd that they figured they would be able to attract on Friday. So that went really well. They ended that day, well, I guess we ended it, let's say, with a Hacker Public Radio panel, which you should hopefully be hearing soon on some distribution channel such as OhioLinux.org or whatever their website is, possibly Hacker Public Radio. As well, it's exciting stuff. The panel just went really, really well. I was really, really impressed. The festival itself on Saturday was busy. I felt it was like just the right amount of people. You know, I mean, you didn't ever feel claustrophobic or too crowded or anything. But you looked out and you saw lots of people, and you didn't see the same people time and time again. You know, there was definitely a lot to do there. Not too much. There was just enough to do, just as many tracks as they needed. It was really quite phenomenal. I felt that they really pulled off a great conference this year. Of course, as me and Snack Machine B were talking about, and Mr. Jackson too, on the way back from the festival, we were talking about these events. Really, I mean, I think that, I mean, there's always going to be something there for you to listen to and to learn. Some talk is going to appeal to you. I think when you're a complete noob to Unix-y things, these kinds of conferences, it's like a candy store. You can just go in so many different directions, or you can just go into one track and sit all day, and it's fine. Now, after a fashion, you start to get a little bit more, I guess, expertise in Linux or BSD or whatever you're running, and so you've got this, you start to look for more specific information, and whether a talk or any of the three or four talks at one any given hour time slot is actually going to fulfill that question or not is kind of up in the air. I mean, if you know everything that you need to know about the topic in track 1, 2, 3, and 4, then that's it. You know, you're not going to go and sit through them again. So I think after a while, you start to get very specific in your needs, and in a way, sometimes that lessens attendance on the talks, and then in some ways it increases your ability to contribute elsewhere. So one of the things that I did at the festival, not that I feel like I know everything about all the, you know, everything that was talked about, but I didn't feel the urgent need to go to all of the talks like I kind of used to. So I was able to be behind the KDE booth, and that was really fun. It was me, Mako, and a whole bunch of people from I think it was Ohio. It was like ITT, but that doesn't make any sense to me. Indiana Technical Training? I don't know. It was ITT, I think. But a whole bunch of people from there. It was a lot of fun. We absolutely, I mean, there wasn't a competition except in our own minds, but we decided that we were going to have the most computers on our table, as, you know, out of anyone. And that's what we did. We had a laptop running OpenSUSE, KDE, obviously. Slackware, that was mine, KDE, and Fedora, KDE Spin, Kubuntu, another Kubuntu, those were Macos, a FreeBSD, and I thought there was one more, but that might have been it, but there were a lot of laptops on the table. They were all running KDE, and it was really kind of neat because they were all, each and every one, customized for that individual user, which I really, really thought was cool. Because it shows how configurable KDE really is. And I myself have kind of experimented around just in idle time on saying, okay, well, here's KDE. Can I set it up to be a little bit more like, you know, GNOME in layout and stuff like that? And so I'll sit there, not that I actually want that for myself, but I was just curious. And, you know, you can, like, totally change everything and make it however you want it to. It's really, really an interesting experiment, and you'd be amazed at how well it goes. You know, you'll be amazed at how actually you can configure KDE to do pretty much whatever you want it to. You can make it be whatever you want it to. And I showed people that, and that seemed to be a pretty good pitch, because at first, you know, I'm a horrible salesperson. And I mean, my answer to, like, why should I use KDE is either use it if you want to or don't. It doesn't really matter. And that's, I guess, the right answer ultimately. But I mean, if it's not so antagonistic, then, and they're asking, like, well, why should I use KDE? One of the big reasons I use it, I think, is because I can configure it really, really easily to be exactly the style that I want it to be. And I don't mean visual style. I mean all the keyboard shortcuts that I have, which I've discussed in previous episodes. The look of the file manager in terms of if there's a menu bar, and I mean like the file edit view, that kind of menu bar. I can turn that off so quickly. It's a simple matter of Control M, and that removes the menu bar. It's so nice. And so then I can do that. I can turn on and off the icon toolbar, turn it on with icons or text. I mean, all that stuff is kind of standard, but the level of configuration is pretty amazing, and it's maybe difficult to talk about it, but if you ever try it, you'll find that you can really do that. And I do have all the KDE shortcuts for myself, and I'm just amazed at how quick and efficient it becomes for me. I can launch applications at the touch of two keys. I can close windows. You know, I can just do all these different things, and it's so easy, and it's so nice, and it's such a pleasure to use. So that was a lot of fun, was the point of that, I guess. And it went really well. There was obviously a pretty good KDE representation, I think. The Ubuntu booth was right next door to us, and they actually had a whole bunch of Kubuntu disks, so they lent us some of those to hand out. There was an OpenSUSE table to the far right of us, and they lent us some disks to hand out. So not that I actually use either of those or necessarily recommend them, and I didn't really hand the CDs out, and I really tried to pimp Slackware as much as I could, and Fedora as much as I could. It was just, sorry about the traffic noise, if you can hear that. I'm not sure if you can, but I am sitting sort of outside-ish. But yeah, I mean, it was good to have something with KDE but as the default install. I guess none of us had really considered that as something to have. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was meeting people, answering questions, talking about why we like KDE, things like that. I mean, it was actually a really pleasant way to spend the festival. So if there's a project, a pet project that you like, that you want to support or whatever, you might want to look into, you know, helping out on some of their promotional things. The KDE promo list is KDE-promo, and you can find that list probably on KDE.org. I'll try to find it and put it in the show notes. And yeah, so that was really cool. Let's talk about some other stuff now from OLF. Notably, let's see, so the social aspect is important, right? That was another thing that a lot of us were talking about how a big part of this kind of thing. I mean, you can meet people online and talk about the technical aspect of Linux and rave about it and all that other stuff, but it is always different to meet them in person and actually hang out with them and go to dinner with them and just random things like that. That's a lot of fun. And it's not to be underestimated, and it's not as scary as it might seem to a lot of people, myself included. I was reflecting on my history of conferences. Before I went to technical conferences, I would go to other technical, they were called trade shows in the industry that I was really interested in, which was the film industry and stuff. So you go to the trade shows and see all the new stuff. And I would always go with a friend or two, because, I mean, that's kind of the way to make it really easy on yourself, and you don't have to meet people. And there's not at all the communal sense in something like a trade show. That's just not the same thing. You meet people, and yes, you're all there together, but that doesn't mean you all want to be there together. It doesn't mean that you have had any interaction with each other beforehand. So the Linux technical conferences, the Linux trade shows, if you will, I guess that's why they call it the festivals, the Ohio Linux Festival and the Southeast Linux Festival. Those are really much more of, I guess, a celebration of Linux and something that people go to because they want to, and they expect to see a lot of diversity in who shows up between vendors, business people, enthusiasts, programmers, beta testers, whatever. So it's a cool thing that you get that kind of almost presumed and built-in social aspect, kind of like, hey, you're going to go to this thing, and it's not just going to be a trade show, it's going to be somewhere where you should talk to people and meet new people and make friends or meet friends that you have online already or whatever. And I did that a lot this year. Again, I really had scaled back to some degree, to maybe a large degree, my involvement with like the festival's operations. You know, I didn't do that sort of thing as much this year. So I was able to just kind of sit back and meet new people and talk to them. And you know, I can't really actually mention any names. Inevitably, I will forget to mention someone, and then I will look like a jerk, and it is not a good thing. So there was one person who came all the way from like Texas, and it was really strange, very strange and funny person. I knew him from IRC, and I had never met him, but he kind of made an impression, I think, on everyone, because he gave out a gift of a DVD, of a Blu-ray DVD, no less. So that's obviously fairly pointless for me, because I'm a Linux user and can't watch Blu-ray DVDs, and it was, of course, the day the Earth stood still. But the really, really funny thing about this gift that this person, whose name I'm not going to mention, because I find it such an integral part of this show to not mention names and then leave other people out. So this person gave me this disc, and what was really funny, and I think this is why he gave me the disc, was that it was actually a 3-disc set. So there was the new version of the day the Earth stood still. There was the old version, which, you know, admittedly that's pretty cool, but again, it's on Blu-ray, so it's not going to do me a bit of good yet. And then finally, there was this third disc labeled digital copy. Okay, so understand that DVDs are a digital media. You know, you don't put it on like a platter and put a little recording or a little play needle head on the thing, and like a record, you know, and they have it spin around and read the grooves of the DVD. So it's really funny to me that one of the discs would be labeled digital copy. I mean, it's not untrue. It is a digital copy, but I mean, it's also not at all unique. So it was a really bizarre label, and it turns out that what this is a disc with the movie, I guess, on it in DRM, you know, some kind of DRM format, so that you can actually have a quote-unquote ripped copy of this movie without actually ripping it. Now, the prevailing conspiracy theory, which pretty much sounds right, is that this is a clever way for them to give you that privilege of having a digital backup copy that, I guess, whoever the copyright office or the you know, whoever allows these sorts of things, they've deemed that, yes, it's okay to have a digital backup, personal backup copy of a movie. That's cool. But, of course, they don't want you to be able to do that yourself, really. I mean, why would they? Why wouldn't it be so much better if they could start this tradition of giving people digital copies, which they can make you enter in a serial number or a receipt number, a UPC number, or something like that? I mean, the more controls that they can have over this situation, sort of like, okay, well, if people are allowed to have their own digital copy of something, then we'll give them the digital copy, but we're going to put DRM on it. So very, very strange and fairly humorous. So thanks to the person whose name I am not going to mention. That was much appreciated. And I'm sure that when Linux cracks the Blu-ray, well, Linux won't, but a developer will. A developer cracks the Blu-ray DRM content protection or whatever, then maybe I'll actually get to see this copy of the movie, and maybe I'll be impressed. Thank you very much. It was very thoughtful. So that was that person. There's two other people who I do have to mention the names of. One, because it's just a tradition, and then two, because it's an obligation. So the tradition is Sigflup. I've talked about her on the show, of course. She's the one who does like a lot of the Hacker Public Radio stuff. Like, if you've ever heard the Uber Elite Hacker Force miniseries on Hacker Public Radio, then that would be her. And as I've mentioned, I mean, she's written into the show and stuff like that before as well. She showed up, which I did expect. It was kind of, I had been led to believe that she would show up. So she did, which was really, really cool. And we got to be on the Hacker Public Radio panel together, and I got to see her with a lot of other people do her cross-compiling for game console developing talk, or just some such thing as that. And that went way over my head. The really neat thing about that talk, however, was that if you will look back for the first mention of Sigflup that I ever made, because this was like the first time I actually really met her, you know, online in person, it was like about this sprite editor that she had developed or something, and that she was like asking me to beta test her, or maybe just test. I'm not really sure. I don't remember it at this moment, but she helped me compile it, because I had hit a couple of snags, but I got it compiled, and I looked at it, and I had no idea what it was all about, and I said, yep, looks good. And it was really cool, because in this presentation, she used that application. Like, she did a demo of that little sprite editor, but it was cool, because even if I didn't contribute to it, I'd seen, like, I guess, an early copy of it or something, and so that was really cool to see. The other cool thing, and this is really cool, is the whole cross-compiling thing, which is the real part, that was really why I wanted to see the talk, because I've wanted to look into cross-compiling for some time. And cross-compiling, if you don't know, is being able to sit down at, for instance, let's say, a PowerPC box, and fire up GCC, and do a compile of some source code, compile some source code, but have it, and then you end up with like a little binary, right? So you take that binary and throw it over onto an Intel box and run it. And yes, it has been compiled essentially as an Intel binary. That's cross-compiling. Why would you want to do that? Well, you'd want to do it for a number of reasons. One would be, if I've got a PowerPC box and an Intel box sitting next to each other, and suddenly I want to compile something, why do it on one when you can, on the one that you're working on, for instance, if you can do it on the other one that you're not working on, that's going to sit there idly while you're using one computer? So I have recently acquired a PowerPC G5 tower, and so I thought it would be really great to have this right next to my main workstation at my day job, and it'll be sitting there idly all day, but what I can do is farm out all kinds of jobs to it, whether it's compiling something, or whether it's processing docbook stuff, or whether it's rendering video or whatever. But one of those things, the compiling things, I couldn't do unless I knew how to do that. So her talk went over that, and if you go to uberelitehackerforce.deepgeek.us and you look in the files section, and that's spelled the very hip way of PHYLEZ possibly, then you should see her show notes eventually. If not right now, then eventually. But anyway, Sigflup, in terms of the Sigflupness, meeting her was as good as you would imagine it would be. I mean, she was just a really cool person. She's as cool in real life as she was is on her shows. She's a real artist and just brilliant. I mean, as far as I can tell, a brilliant programmer. And I got to see her kind of a laptop that sort of hacked together laptop. So that was really cool to see. I also got to see her PassyPass, which is really cool. If you haven't seen this or heard of it, you need to check this out. You seriously need to check this out. What this is a little box that Sigflup herself designed. I mean, like, I'm talking schematics designed, like the whole chipboard and stuff like that, with little chips on it. And she designed, and she programmed, apparently from the ground up. Didn't exist before, and now it does. So she did all this, and what the PassyPass does, and right now there is but one prototype. So what this does is you go to a website, and you plug the PassyPass in via the USB, and you go to this website, and you can click on the username, and then you type in your username, and you press the U button, and that sets the username as that username that you've just entered. And then you go into the password field and you enter the password. No, actually, I think you just press password, and that auto-generates a random-ish password. And I say random-ish because Sigflup says, well, I'm not a cryptographer or whatever, and of course neither am I. So I guess the question of random will always be a question, right? No one ever knows how random anything really is, but it has some kind of thing that it calculates, you know, based on some fairly, potentially very random events. So it does that. It generates this password, and then you can go into a terminal and press some other button, and it outputs, I think, possibly the UP at the same time or something like that, and it outputs a little menu. Yes, the PassyPass is outputting a little menu into, I think you just use a text editor just to actually read what it's outputting. It's really cool. And so it outputs a little menu there, and then it gives you some choices, and you can save that username and that password in any of, four buttons, A, B, C, or D, but then you can also have combinations thereof. So you could have, okay, this is going to be A, this is going to be B, this is going to be C, this is going to be D. This one is going to be AB, this one's going to be AC, this one's going to be AD, and then BC, and then BD, and then I guess something else. So you can have, you know, combinations of button presses. But anyway, you store this stuff in those buttons. And then, of course, when you go back to that site next time, you are able to simply load that username and password into the PassyPass and send those usernames and password, that username and password, out of the PassyPass into the text input field right there in your browser, and it logs you in. And it's completely cool. It is really neat. The really clever thing about this, I think, is that there is no indication, really, of what site this is for. So it is something that even if Sigflup, if I'd stolen Sigflup's prototype of the PassyPass, I wouldn't have known what site to use her username and password with. So I thought that was all very, very clever. And to see it was just really cool. And the other name that I really need to mention is Mordancy, or Mordancy. I'm not sure how you really say it, and I forgot to ask him. But this guy is flat-out incredible. Speaking of true artists, this guy is a silk screen printer, but I don't know that that's all he is, so I'll just call him a t-shirt maker. But anyway, on Thursday, before I left for Ohio Linux Fest, he emailed me and said, hey, I would like to make you a Hacker Public Radio t-shirt. What do you say? And I said, well, you know what would really probably do me even more, you know, would be more useful to me is a GNU World Order shirt, because then I could get the word out of my show. I could, you know, kind of show my own show pride, and also people wouldn't perpetually believe that Hacker Public Radio is my show, because as I've said before, it is not. It's Enigma's show. I merely contribute when I can contribute, and I've heard in a couple of places, you know, that it's my show, or that it's Klaatu and his Hacker Public Radio correspondence, you know, things like that. That's not the case. So I didn't feel like being the only person with a Hacker Public Radio radio t-shirt on at OLF would benefit anything. And we were having an HPR panel anyway, so it's getting its fair share of advertisement. I figured GNU World Order could get a little bit. So I whipped up a design really, really quick, actually based on another design that I'm doing for a different project. But I whipped this up, sent it to him, and I thought that it was probably pretty crazy to do that, because it probably is pretty difficult to actually make that happen. You know, it just can't really be that easy to just email him a design and him show up the next day with a t-shirt. And wouldn't you know, he showed up the next day with a t-shirt. It was amazing. It was a black t-shirt. It's got white print, and it is just so cool. I've never really seen a serious design of mine on a t-shirt before. And this was like a design that I felt good about. You know, this was like one of those works that, yeah, I liked. You know, I thought, okay, this is going to be cool. And I saw it on the shirt, and it was just really, really incredible to see, like, that and the name of the show on a t-shirt, because I mean, now it's real, right? It's like a Tilts show. It's the real deal. I have a t-shirt. I ended up giving one. He gave me 3 copies of the t-shirt because he wasn't sure of my size, I guess. So one was a small, one was medium, one was large. So I gave one to Sigflup and then one to someone else. I don't actually recall who. And then one the other one to me. And then he also gave me 2 free Anarchy shirts. And I was able to give one of those away to my fellow Unix porn system administrators, Cobra 2, who showed up at the conference. Remember how I said I wasn't going to mention any names? I think so far I've dropped like 3 or 4, but sorry everyone who I didn't mention. So I could mention Monster B and Terry F, who completely didn't take the G5 towers that I was going to give them, so that was really nice of them, I guess. But anyway, I'm not going to mention any more names. So, that was the festival, I guess, in the long and short of it. That was, and I could go on and on. It was really a fantastic time. Everyone had fun. There was a lot to do. There were plenty of people to hang out with and talk to. I can proudly say, I can very proudly say, that at one point, we had basically the IRC channel, Ogcast Planet, except instead of being in text mode, we were in real life, you know, human being mode. We were all in this really goofy looking circle in, you know, chairs, and we were all sitting around and talking, IRC style, I guess, and it was really strange, and it worked, almost. It was, you know, it's a toss-up as to whether I prefer the text or the humans. It's fun both ways, I guess. So I guess I like both. But it was a lot of fun, and I can proudly say that our re-implementation of IRC in live action was so loud, and so we were having such a lot of fun, apparently, that the closing keynote being given by John Mad Dog Hall, they actually had to shut the doors on that because we were making too much noise. And I thought that that was something to be fairly proud of. It was definitely worth any amount of effort getting there, and some people drove quite a ways to get there. Some people, well, I guess a lot of people probably took off work for it, and it was worth it. I would be surprised if you could find one person who said it was not worth it. So yeah, Ohio Linux Fest, really, really cool. And actually, you know what, I should mention one more name, since I said I was not going to mention names, but this will segue into my next segment, actually, and that is CLI Magic. And CLI Magic did a great talk on the command line, like just random tips and tricks and things like that. The cool thing about this, though, and he was at the Hacker Public Radio talk, and he and I had a total misunderstanding. He thought I was talking about an Adobe project, product of all things, and I was talking about a very specific term, and when he asked the question about that, I thought he was kidding, so I was kind of kidding around with him until I realized that he actually thought I really was. So then it was a really awkward, like, bad way to get off off of meeting each other. However, we kept kind of talking here and there. He's got a really cool, I guess it's an Identica feed. I'm not going to look at it because I don't do Identica, but I know a lot of you do, and they're apparently just random, you know, command line tips delivered to you in an Identica feed. I don't know on what, you know, how often they are sent out or whatever, but I just thought that was a really cool idea and a really clever way of contributing back to the community, because he was actually like saying, hey, you know, I feel like I should probably do like an HPR episode. And I told him, yeah, you should, because that would be cool. But also, it seems like you know, he's kind of got his own little Hacker Public Radio thing going on, because he's sending it out there. He's getting it out to people. He's getting the information out, which I just thought was actually really cool. So yeah, thanks CLA Magic for providing all those tutorials. So yeah, check his feed out, and I think he's either got, well, I know he's got a blog or something. I'll put all these links in the show notes, because I just got back, so a lot of this information is kind of off the top of my head. Okay, next we're going to talk about handles. So handles. I think this topic comes up probably once or twice at any Linux conference or technical convention, and that is how do you address your fellow geek? You met them in IRC and you know them by a handle, and so then you meet them in real life. So what do you call them? You know, do you call them Zero Cool or do you call them Bob? It's a kind of a tough call. And it is, at least for me, it's a huge leap. I cannot make that leap very well. If I've met someone as Zero Cool, then I'm not going to call them Bob when I meet them in real life. It's like arbitrarily reassigning a name to someone all of a sudden. You know, just so I was kind of thinking about this, and then started talking to a couple of people about it later, and I thought, you know, handles. Perhaps, well, one of the things that we also mentioned was that we're really bad with names. And then I thought, well, wait, actually, I don't know that I'm bad with handles. I'm actually pretty good with handles. In fact, I'm quite good with handles. I can call people, I can remember their handles. Just as a, for instance, I met a lot of people at the KDE booth. To be precise, I met a lot of people who were at the KDE booth for most of the day. Like, they were sitting there, they were talking to me, I was talking to them. I should know their name. But right now, I couldn't tell you their name. I just do not remember it. I can picture the face, I can picture what distro they were running, I can picture which laptop they owned. I cannot tell you their name. On the other hand, and I happened to be walking through the halls of the Drury Inn, which is the kind of the hotel associated with the Ohio Linux Fest for, I guess, most of the years. And we were just walking around. It was late, so not a lot of people were in the halls. And we happened to cross this random group of other people walking through halls. And so we chatted a little bit, and we all gave each other our handles, you know. So I could tell you each of those handles quite easily, and I can picture their face, and I can tell you exactly probably what they were wearing and everything. I mean, it was just with their handle, I can. There's so much more. So why is that, right? Well, if you think about what a name is, and so what we will call names and handles. So if you think of what a name is, it really is a non-unique and quite arbitrary word that is associated with a person. So if I know someone named Mary, why is she called Mary? She didn't choose Mary for herself, probably. Most people don't. Not that there's anything wrong with the name Mary, but I mean, you don't choose your own name usually. So you didn't choose it. You didn't choose it recently. You can't tell me exactly why that name is your name. Maybe you can. Maybe it's a family name. Maybe it's a religiously, you've got a religious link to it. But a lot of people, I mean, it's just a name. It's just what they were born, they got named, and that's it. So there's no, like, emotional or intuitive connection between that word and that person. And it's really a force of repetition that makes, I think, most people kind of remember names. And that's kind of true. I mean, I work with people, and I think, okay, so here's this person, and I know who they are, but I can't think of their name, you know, and you can see them like 2 and 3 times a day, but if you don't really talk to them or use their name in a sentence all the time, then you don't know their name. There's also the problem of okay, here's Mary. I see her a lot. I don't actually use her name, so I don't know her name, but her name is Mary. But how many other Marys do I know? Quite possibly a lot. It might be a very common name. It might not be the most common name, but maybe you've still heard it a couple of times. Maybe it's a familiar name to you. So it's very, very non-unique. There's nothing really special about that name to make it stand out to you. It's just one of those common, in your country, you know, one of those names that people get to choose from when they're naming a person. So handles, on the other hand, are chosen. They're picked by the person themselves. If you, quite frequently, it's a fairly recent thing. I mean, in terms of, you know, they weren't born and then they got a handle. They chose their handle when they came of computer using age, and it's significant to them for some reason. Now, it might not be something so significant that it really has, like, an emotional impact. I mean, like, okay, Klaatu, I've said before, is not an original name or for me, a handle, right? I mean, Klaatu is the name of a very famous science fiction character. It's not unique, but it is suggestive of who I am, my I guess persona or whatever, you know, a little bit science fictiony and spacey and technical or whatever you associate with you know, Klaatu with, has a big robot, you know, whatever. It kind of suggests what the person is about, and if that person kind of follows through with that, for instance, a lot of people do know that I actually do watch a lot of sci-fi and read a lot of science fiction, and I play spacey, trippy music in my show. You know, so I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, it all kind of makes sense. Or maybe there is some kind of story behind it, you know? Well, why did you choose the name Cobra 2? Oh, well, it's my password. Why did you... Not really. Why did you choose, you know, whatever. Then from then on, you know, you've got that sort of little story, that little bit of a little personal unique touch to that handle. And that's pretty cool and makes it a lot easier to remember, I think. Combine the personal touch with the sort of suggestiveness of that person and their personality, and then in addition to that, just the uniqueness of it, because you don't really, I mean, amazingly, you don't really see that many of the same handle, especially in one given crowd, you know, like within a certain community. Very often there aren't duplicate handles, I mean, unless those handles are names, you know, Bill 1 and Bill 2, okay, they didn't come up with a cool handle, but although even then, that kind of makes it unique, doesn't it? That it's not unique. But within that community, there's that limited set of names, and so you kind of know which Klaatu that is. You know that when someone says, you know, in a Linux multimedia discussion, they say, oh, you should listen to Klaatu's podcast, it's really good about multimedia stuff, then they're probably talking about me and not some other Klaatu associated with MySQL or something that I don't know anything about. So there's that as well, the uniqueness of a lot of the handles. So yeah, that's just really just random thoughts about names and handles, and maybe even a proposition that we should just do away with the whole naming convention, or maybe have temporary names. You know, maybe we just go by variables at first, and then we can choose our own name/handle later in life or something. I don't know. I'm not really being serious. Although I should be serious. I should totally make this serious and actually mandate that's what I insist we all do, so that it can really be kind of that whole GNU World Order thing, you know, like very strict and sort of 1984-ish. But that's not really what the GNU World Order is about anyway, so I won't be that way. And that is my thoughts on names and handles. If you have an opinion, you certainly may email me about it. Or not. Doesn't really matter. In fact, if we want to do this, kind of make it even more fun, if you have an interesting story about your handle, email me and tell me what it is, and I will read your email on the show. And if I find anything cool to send you, I could probably try to do that, although, to be fair, I gave away most of my stuff at Ohio Linux Fest, which actually brings me to a tangent quickly, that Linux Fests are a really good place to get rid of things. Really, you can, if you have a shirt that you want to get rid of, I mean, you know, like, it's a nice shirt, but, you know, maybe it doesn't fit you, or then give it away to someone. They'll probably take it. If you have a computer, bring it to the convention and give it away to someone. That's what Russ Wenner did, and that was his idea last year. He did a little bit of that. That was really successful. And this year, there was, like, a Solaris box on a table with a little note that says, call, you know, such and such a number for a Solaris box. And sure enough, there it was. So it was really neat. And I guess that's about all I have to say about handles, names, and OLF. Let's talk about FreeBSD and KDE.
Drink coffee. It'll do you good.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's talk about KDE and FreeBSD. And as I mentioned, I was at the KDE booth, and as I mentioned, I had a FreeBSD notebook up there along with Slackware and OpenSUSE and Fedora and Kubuntu. So the FreeBSD laptop almost didn't make it, because as I said in the last episode, which was the last episode of the previous season, 5X20, the BSD and the KDE thing weren't really playing nice together. And I wasn't sure why, but I figured it was probably my fault. And sure enough, it is. So here's the answer. The reason that it wasn't working really, really well together was that I hadn't entered a couple of magical incantations into the rc.conf file. Now, /etc, of course, holds a lot of configuration files for the system, right? These aren't the user configuration files. These aren't, like, your Mozilla Firefox settings or your, well, even your Conqueror settings, right? I mean, it doesn't have the look and feel of your desktop on it. These are system things. So in Slackware and BSD both, there are these little rc.foo files, and I don't know what they do, but one of the two that I use is in Slackware, this one called /etc/rc.d/rc.local. And what that basically is, it's the final RC little conf file that the system is going to look at right before it drops you into, I guess, what they call user land, or you know, into the, basically your, you know, the prompt to start logging in and stuff. So this is a really handy little configuration file, because it's one of those things where, yeah, you might have activated, you might have had rc.sshd start at boot time, and you might have, or you might not, to save boot speed, or you might have rc.cupsd start at boot time, whatever. Well, maybe there's something that you want to have happen that isn't really spoken for. There's no rc.anything for it yet, and you want it to come last in the order of these events. You put it in rc.local, and I used this for my Emacs speak setup, which I went over on this show. I use it there for the vocal prompt for the blind user that says, "Hi, you're about to log in now." It's just basically the last thing that the system does before dropping you at the login prompt. And so I have flight say, you know, please log in or something like that. And then you wait a beat, and then you are indeed at the login prompt. So that's rc.local. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. On BSD, it's /etc/rc.conf, I guess, is sort of the main RC dot, or the main configuration file. From what I can tell, sort of like stuff to do before something like start X is given. Or actually, I mean, before you log in, essentially. And someone can correct me on the technicalities of this if they want to. I'm not that deep into this yet to be able to tell you exactly what it does. But it is that kind of like, it's like, okay, let's get all these things done before we try to let the user log in and start using this system. Let's make sure that some services are running. And so in there, you're going to see things like inet underscore enable, inetd underscore enable, yes or no. You can set your host name there, host name equals foo, mouseD enable, yes. You know, just different things like that that you want to make sure that they're turned on before you try to start using your system. So it turns out that some of the good ones to add in there to get KDE to really work well is local underscore startup equals, and then quotes, $ curly brackets, local underscore startup, end curly bracket, space, /user/local/KDE4/etc/rc.d. And what that says is that on the local system, as it were, you know, the part of the user experience that the user has put together, which is in user local, right? Because local means that you've installed it on a BSD system, and a Slackware system usually, /user/local/KDE4/etc/rc.d, meaning, hey, look in that folder for these very specific things that KDE wants you to do before it starts. And then the other line is KDEM4_enable=yes. So these were two really, really important lines of I guess, code that I really should have had in my /etc/rc.conf file, and I didn't, probably because I didn't know where to look for the notification that I was supposed to do that. I'm going to assume that the port tells you to put those lines in rc.conf, or it won't work properly, or it won't work as well as you want it to. Like, you won't be able to actually start applications because it won't know where to look for them, things like that. So I'm assuming that someone tells you that in some notification or message, and I just didn't know where to look. Maybe there's a log for ports that I need to be checking. I'm really not sure quite yet, but I'm sure I will learn. But the point being is that if you're going to do a FreeBSD install and you want to do the KDE 4 port install or compiling it, whatever, make sure that you add those lines into the system so that it actually works for you like you need it to work for you. And let's see, well, I guess that's about it for the KDE BSD thing. So I guess progress reports, since I kind of did say that I was going to give some progress reports, it's actually going really, really well. I continue to really, really admire this system. It's hard to understand because it's kind of like, well, what do people mean when they say, oh, it's really well put together, it feels so clean, it feels so neat and tidy. It just does. Once you know where something goes, like especially the /usr/local thing, which I really, really like, and like I say, I got introduced to that with Mac ports. They always put everything in /opt. And I remember really liking that. And then later on, I got used to it in Slackware because most, if not all, things that you install yourself go into the /user/local/whatever. You know, there's that separation of like, okay, did I do it or did the system do it? Did it come by default, whatever. I like that a lot, and I know that probably other systems do the same thing. I'm not saying that other Linux distributions don't do that, but it seems to me like they're a lot more consistent on Slackware and BSD. BSD also, as I said in the previous episode, really, really big on kind of like doing things the quote-unquote right way, which is cool. I like that. I'm not saying that it's the only way to get something done, because, hey, people hack, right? I mean, that's why the term hack came around, because sometimes the right way is too hard, or it takes too long, or it's just not something that you know how to do yet. But it turns out that if you do such and such, then it does work. The bad side to that is that your code might not be as portable as it probably should be. But the good side of that is that, well, people have something that works on you know, a lot of systems. So understanding both sides of the stories, there's certainly a lot of admiration for something that champions itself on doing things this certain way, you know, the standard way. It's really kind of nice. I also figured out how to fix the touchpad, and there is a Linux Questions forum posting about that, so I will reference you to that. It is simply kind of investigating how exactly to find out what the mouse driver is and what to enter into xorg.conf so that it actually works the way you want it to work. And I thank Monster B and The Last Known God for... Actually, not The Last Known God. He didn't help me. I do thank Monster B, though, for helping me out on that. That was much appreciated. And The Last Known God helped me network, though. Okay, here's an interesting story. So I was standing around trying to get the BSD box that I had on the Exhibitor Wi-Fi. Slackware got on there really, really easy. So I went over to the BSD laptop and remembered that there's no Wi-Fi manager that actually seems to work with BSD properly. So at least not that I had found yet. I'm not saying there isn't one. I'm saying I didn't know of it yet. So I fired up a terminal and, you know, obviously just usual sequence of commands like iwlist wn 0 scan, and oops, what do you know, there is no such command. All right, how about an iwconfig? No command for that either. So then I'm left with ifconfig, and it turns out that I couldn't figure out how to assign the information that I needed to assign via ifconfig. I worked on that a little bit and got that down. Had to do some really weird things about forcing BSD to stop trying to just locate the first available network. So the answer to that was, don't use ifconfig, use WPA supplicant. Good thing I had to learn that a couple of months ago for some other entirely unrelated issue. Actually, it was what, WEP through WPA supplicant? So that was really great. So I knew WPA supplicant pretty well. I put in some entries into WPA supplicant, fired that up, got the DHCP address from the router, and in theory, I was ready to go. But I couldn't get online. The problem ended up being names the resolve.conf, and it did actually for some reason have my old information in it. Maybe I hadn't given enough time for the system to kind of correct that or something. But yeah, it was the wrong resolve. It was wrong name servers. So I tried to correct that with some random numbers that I thought might work for some reason. They didn't. So then the last night, known God, well, actually, I think he was the one who suggested looking in resolve.conf in the first place, which was really nice troubleshooting. Something I should have known, because I've had to do that a couple of times, but I guess just not enough to really jump at that. So he recognized it right away and said, hey, look in resolve.conf. Didn't work. And then he just, recites the open DNS numbers off the top of his head. It was like, I forget what it was, 208.267.202.202. And something like that, but it was incredible. I typed it in, pinged a URL, and yeah, we're online. It was really, really cool. So I think the lesson here, in a very broad sense, is that as a noob, a permanent noob, the one thing I've learned is that a lot of times when you're trying to do something on a system, especially when it's a system that everyone seems to like, or that gives a lot of strong praise from people that you respect, that would actually be a lot more meaningful than everyone, since everyone seems to like Windows. But, you know, it gets a lot of praise from people that you respect. If you can't figure out how to do something, chances are, much as I hate to say it, the problem is you, which sounds harsh, but I'm saying it about myself, too. The thing is that it's really hard for a noob to actually find a bug in the program. You know, something that just some developer somewhere didn't think to do. It's just not that, I mean, it's not completely unheard of by any means, and we should all look for bugs. But to sit around and complain about how BSD is just no good because, well, it can't even run KDE, and it can't even get on a network for me, is really quite useless. And I do try to avoid it. I try to avoid complaining about things like that. I mean, everyone gets frustrated. I know I do. I do complain sometimes. But I think that if we take a step back from the complaining sometimes and try to figure out really what we're doing wrong, what can we read, what can we look up, who can we ask to help us figure something out. A lot of times I think, well, certainly a lot of times for me, I have absolutely found that the problem was not with the application at all. It wasn't even with the hardware sometimes. It was just that I didn't know that I was supposed to do something in order to configure it, to configure that thing in the optimal way that it needs to be configured. Now you can complain about, well, that doesn't seem right, that I wouldn't have known about that. That should have been in big 32-point font size blinking text saying, now you need to add these lines to your rcd.conf file. And to be fair, yes, you're right, that would be nice. But at the same time, maybe it is blinking somewhere and you're just not looking in the right place. And there are avenues that have been kind of set up in most systems. You know, look here, and look here. Consult these things and but a lot of times the answers are there. We're just not looking around for them, or we haven't integrated ourselves enough into the way that things are done in that system that we know to look there. For instance, a README file in source code. It's usually there. If you read it, 9 times out of 10, it will solve your compile problems. Just random things like that. And just because, as I say quite often, just because other systems do it a different way, you know, they have a big pop-up window, Unix doesn't necessarily do that. And believe it or not, you don't really want it to, or you might want it to, but you might not want it to. And the default behavior, at least right now, is that it doesn't do that. It's not going to interrupt your workflow that you might be scripting or something like that to tell you, okay, now you need to go do such and such. Is there another way to do it? Yeah, maybe there's some other way to deliver that message without interrupting the flow of the work and things like that. But honestly, I think it's more of a line of just kind of getting in tune with what you're trying to learn. And I know that that's been very, very true with me. I mean, sometimes I'll in very, very kind of like, oh, I'll prove you wrong moments, I'll do something, or I'll try to do something, and it just won't work. And then someone who actually knows what they're talking about will come around and say, oh, you mean doing this? And they'll, you know, type in some command or hit some button, and it totally works. So be careful, I guess, is what I'm saying with your complaints, because it is dangerous. You have to kind of make sure that you're doing your research and really, really kind of know where to look and ask around and be polite about it, and chances are you're going to learn some cool stuff. That's been kind of what's been going on for me, so check it out. Check what out? I'm not really sure, actually. I think I just said that, but yes, let's talk about the next topic. Okay, actually, I guess I lied. I mean, this is a great way for you to see that this is, in fact, the same show, even though I did change the name of it, because Hey, I've run out of time for listener feedback. Yes, it's true. It's like 54 minutes in, and probably I should be wrapping it up rather than going into listener feedback. So, next episode we'll cover some listener feedback and some other topics that I'm sure I have lying around somewhere. So, as always, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for tuning back in for the exciting sixth season, and I will see you next time. Been New World Order. My name is Klaatu, and you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also email me at klaatu@hackrepublicradio.org. You can go to the website at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Feel free to also IM me. I'm sometimes on IM, not always, but it is at notklaatu@jabber.org. And you can generally find me in IRC on irc.freenode.net as, again, not Klaatu. So, again, thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Listening.